This sermon was uploaded by Grace Community Church in San Antonio, Texas, and our website is www.gccsatx.com, or you can find us on Sermon Audio by going to www.sermonaudio.com/gcc.
Questions? Let's continue watching John. It was wonderful to be around such godly people. I wish I could have attended more of the classes, but we were kind of busy there at the booth. But what I did attend was absolutely wonderful. So it was really good. Those guys are just, they convict me about as much as anybody on the face of the earth. They're the real deal. They'll witness a signpost. And we're good to go. All right. Well, let's go to Isaiah 62:5. An absolutely marvelous verse in the Bible. Now we're discussing, of course, the motivation of God for sending His Son, first of all, and then the motivation of the Son for coming to this earth, walking upon it as a man, bearing our sin, and dying in our place. Someone might ask why we've spent so much time here. Because it is foundational to understanding everything. And it is foundational to being able to really rejoice in the Lord. To the degree that we recognize His supremacy, His infinite goodness, His mercy, to the degree that we recognize our own depravity and lack of worth, to that degree, we can worship God because of the cross of Calvary. I want you to see the great divide that exists between man and God, because only then can you see and appreciate what God has done for you in Christ. And to recognize that these motivations that led the Father to send His Son and led the Son to come, they sprang forth from the Godhead and not from us. One of the things that I recall that we went over that Spurgeon talked about that was so amazing was after we had fallen, if the entire human race would have fell on its face before God and pleaded for mercy and pleaded for a Redeemer, and if because of that God had sent a Redeemer, it would have been infinite grace. But that wasn't the case. After we fell, we did not humble ourselves, we did not plead for a Redeemer, but we rebelled and continued in our blasphemies and sin against God. So therefore, how much more magnified is the grace of God in the sending His Son, Jesus Christ. So now we look at Isaiah 62:5. For as a young man marries a virgin, so your sons will marry you. And as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so your God will rejoice over you. Now I've written here, the most intimate language is employed here to communicate the nature and extent of Christ's joy in the bride that He has redeemed for Himself. He found her accursed, He redeemed her with His blood. He transformed her by His power, and He presents her to Himself with boundless joy. Now, before we go on and look at some of the things that have been written, I just want us to look at this text for a moment. As a young man marries a virgin, so your sons will marry you, and as a bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so your God will rejoice over you. I can't think of anything more anticipated than when a young man proposes to a young lady and then anticipates their marriage. I can't think of anything more heart-throbbing than the man anticipating the first night of their marriage. How he will rejoice over his bride. How all he can think about is that. And as a man, it says here, marries a virgin with joy, with exceeding great joy. This is something that even in human poetry goes beyond our ability to describe. And yet, that can't even begin to describe God's sentiment and Christ's sentiment towards His church. The great love that He has for His church, and the fact, the anticipation, His waiting and longing to one day unite His church with Him in glory, and that the church might see all His glory and be blessed by it. I find it interesting here, and we'll comment on this again, as a young man marries a virgin. The idea of purity here. And yet, the bride of Christ, prior to her conversion, was by no means a virgin, but a great sinner with terrible, terrible trespasses, terrible blasphemies, terrible ways in which she prostituted herself. But she was washed by the blood of the Lamb, and He continues working in her all the days of her life to present her to Himself spotless. Let's go on. Read here that Matthew Henry writes, "This is very applicable to the love Christ has for His church and the complacency He takes in it." Now, listen to what he's saying. Not just that He has a love for the church, but a complacency in the sense that He's pleased and rejoices in and joys in watching the church and fellowshipping with the church. You know, I knew of a man who told me one of the saddest things I'd ever heard. He said, "I love my sons, but I don't like them." His sons were wayward, caused him a great deal of problems. He did not watch them with joy. He did not contemplate them with gladness. They were a burden to him. When they walked in the room, it was almost like it was a burden heaped upon his shoulders because of the way they acted and what they did. That is not the case with the bride of Christ. Christ not only loves His church, but takes great joy in His church. And this opens up a lot of things for us. First of all, His mercy. Love truly does pass over or overlook a multitude of sins. That He would take joy in someone like me as a microcosm, and as a macrocosm, the church as a whole, that He would take joy, demonstrates His pity, His grace, His mercy. But not only that, what I want you to see is this idea that He has a church out there that is carnal and wicked and worldly is a lie. It is a lie, and one of the greatest blasphemies uttered from pulpits today. Now, the Church of Jesus Christ, even in America, yes, sins and can be wayward at times. But by and large, she is a bride that is being transformed and changed, and she's walking before her husband broken and growing and becoming more and more sanctified. So the idea that someone could be a Christian and live in a continual state of carnality and backsliding all the days of their life without making any progress in the faith is absolutely absurd. Not only absurd, it's blasphemous. Because Christ not only justifies His bride, that is, makes her legally right, but He changes her. He changes her. He transforms her. He sanctifies her. And that's what He says He's doing in Ephesians 5. We understand that from the washing of the Word. Now, He goes on and He says this. This is very applicable to the love of Christ, the love Christ has for His church, and the complacency He takes in it, which appears so brightly in Solomon's song, and which will be complete in heaven. Have any of you ever, and I hope the answer is yes, have any of you ever in times of prayer, in times of calling upon Christ, now this doesn't happen every day, but there are times in prayer when you are literally overwhelmed by the love of God. you literally almost would have to ask God to take His hand off you lest you die. The most extreme case, the most exceptional experiences of the love of God in prayer are not even a dewdrop from the deluge that will be poured out on you in heaven. I mean, most of us, I guess, or all of us have had times in prayer where literally we thought, if this continues, I'm going to die. It's too good. There's too much joy. My heart's going to explode. That's not even the tiniest breath of the storm of God's love. Now, usually we don't use that type of language, the storm of God's love, but I think it's appropriate. Someone asked me one time to describe prayer, and I sat down for a second and I was thinking, well, how do I describe prayer in just one phrase? And finally it just came to me and I said, prayer is like kneeling down 3 feet away from an F5 tornado. That's what prayer is. Now, John Gill writes, Christ is the Lord God of His church and people, Emmanuel, God with us, and He stands in relation of a bridegroom to them. Now this is absolutely amazing. And I want you to look at this. Will Christians be judged? Yes. Do I understand all of that? No, I don't. I don't understand exactly how, all the details of it. But I do know this. The one who judges the unbeliever will judge the unbeliever as a judge, meting out perfect justice. But the one who judges the believer will judge the believer as a father, as a son, as a bridegroom. Now just think about it for a moment. If Joseph could have such pity on Mary, finding her pregnant, thinking that she was in sin, but being a righteous man, he sought to put her away secretly so as not to bring any shame upon her. If Joseph could show that much pity to what he thought was a sinful woman, how much pity will the bridegroom show to his bride on the day that she appears before him, knowing that all her sin has been paid for by his own hand? Now, let me say something here that's very important that a lot of times we don't understand. When you're justified, you're not just pardoned. You say, yes, that's true, Brother Paul. We're given the righteousness of Christ. Yes, but I want you to understand something about this idea of forgiveness. There have been men who have committed horrible crimes only to be pardoned. To be pardoned. And later on, after receiving their pardon, they couldn't bear with their guilt and they ended up committing suicide. Because their guilt was upon them. And why was their guilt upon them? Because they were pardoned, but the crime was never paid for. The guilt was still outstanding. That is not the case with you. You see, you just haven't been pardoned. You were pardoned because the crimes were paid for. The guilt no longer exists. Your conscience is clean because the guilt is not outstanding. It was paid for 100% in the cross of Calvary. So, He stands in relation. The one who's going to judge us stands in relation to us as a bridegroom, as a father, as a brother. That's encouraging. So although I don't understand the ins and outs of what it means for the believer to be judged on that great and final day, I'm not so concerned about it. Yes, I do know what Paul wrote, knowing the fear of the Lord. Hopefully I do fear the Lord. But it brings me great consolation to know that the one who's going to judge me died for me. Now, and they in the relation of a bride to Him. Now, guys, I want us to take sin, our ideas about sin, to a whole new level this morning. Sin is always dirty. But unfaithfulness in the marriage bonds just seems very dirty. The damage it does can many times not even be recuperated. Damage, terrible damage. I want you to look at your sin as unfaithfulness to a spouse, as a horrid thing that does great damage, because you stand in relationship to Him as a bride. Now that language is a little bit difficult for us as men. But what I want you to understand is there's nothing of some kind of twisted femininity here. What He is doing is simply pulling from every example possible to show us the intimacy, the friendship, the love that exists between us and God, and the demands of covenant faithfulness. You sin against your wife. You sin against a husband. You have broken covenant with them. It's a terrible thing. Now, and as such, He rejoices over them with exceeding great joy. I rejoice over my children with exceeding great joy. Even though I have to discipline them, I have to show anger towards them at times, righteous anger. I have to correct them. But I rejoice over my children with exceeding great joy. Even at 4 a.m, like this morning, when my little boy Evan decides that his bed is just a little bit too scary. And so he walks in and, you know, you open up your eyes as a dad, you're sleeping finally, and you think you hear a noise in your sleep, and you open your eyes and there's something staring right at you, and then you leap completely over your wife and push her towards the alien that is coming to the room. But then when I got out of bed, let him crawl up in the bed, and I tucked him in there, he was snuggling beside his mom, as happy as a human gets. I always tell people, when you're too old to do that, and when you're too old to wear those pajamas with the feet in them, with the rubber on the bottom, that's when life starts getting tough. But to just laugh and rejoice, tuck him in and say, okay, I'll get up a half an hour early. Now, if we being evil can rejoice in our children for whom we have not made payment, how much does God rejoice in you? Have you ever thought about God rejoicing over you? I mean, has that ever been a reality? That's sad. You need to think about that. It's exciting when you move into that sphere and begin to think that way. If you come down from a pulpit and everybody in that church is extremely mad at you, and for once, it's not because you did something stupid. It's because you really did preach the truth. And you go back to that hotel room and you get down on your knees, and God rejoices over you. Or when you sit there and build a cabinet by the grace of God, by the strength He's given your mind and your hands to figure out a task, to cut the angles correctly, and it all fits in place. You sit down and look at it, and God rejoices You see how much you miss? What? You think this is a religion? You see how much you can miss? Just real quick, something that may help you. There is nothing more depressing than being around boorish people. Now, what do I mean? I can hardly tolerate being around a person who I say, look at that sunset, and they go, yeah. Or look at that painting, and they're like, yeah. I mean, it's just like, it's like dragging a 400-pound metal ball. It's sad when children are so mesmerized by media, computer games, and everything, they can't appreciate anything. Nothing's beautiful to them. It's just horrible to be around them. It's a drudgery. But to be with someone who appreciates everything is an exciting place to be. You can rejoice with them in their rejoicing. I had an uncle that was like a father to me, and he was a wild man. I mean, a wild man. You ever seen the movie Secondhand Lions, those two fellas? That was my uncle. I mean, really. Really. I'm not exaggerating. I loved being with that guy. I could have more fun going to Walmart with him than going to Paris with somebody else. I mean, everything was amazing. Everything was amazing to him. The idea of rejoicing in God, of God rejoicing with us, can turn the most mundane things into, wow, never seen anything like that before. Now, He rejoices over them with exceeding great joy, and that to do them good. So He rejoiced over them from all eternity. And I think Gil's right here. He just didn't start rejoicing over you the day He saved you. He rejoiced over you from eternity, from before the foundation of the world, anticipating the you He was going to make, the you He was going to save, the you He was going to bring to Himself and glorify. Now think about that. It says, rejoiced over them from all eternity when first betrothed to Him, and so He does in time in redemption. This was the joy set before Him which animated Him to bear the cross. I'm going to that tree. I'm going to that tree. To get my bride, to get my bride, to get my bride. I'm going to do something here that'll make it possible for me to redeem this man and that man and this boy and this girl and this woman. All of them, their names carved into His hands. And despise the shame of it. I mean, to literally just to... We have a word in Spanish that's so strong, menospreciar. Just to, the shame comes up and says, I will confront you. In the cross, this is what you're going to have to deal with. And He just despises it. I don't care. And how does He despise it? Why does He despise it? Because of the joy that was coming to Him in redeeming a people for Himself. That's why I think C.S. Lewis said possibly the greatest evidence of Christianity is joy. Namely, that those would be redeemed and saved by Him and brought to glory. He rejoices at the conversion of them. If angels in heaven rejoice over a sinner being converted, how much more the one who made and redeemed the one being converted? Angels have no stock in any of this. They didn't make you. They didn't die for you. Yet when you were converted, they rejoiced with exceeding great joy. How much the one who made you and redeemed you? And will present them to Himself with joy in the spiritual and personal reign, and to His Father at the last day, and particularly... What is meant here, there will be such a profusion of blessing on the church in the latter day as will abundantly show the joy of Christ in His people. Now, look at this. He mentions the joy not only of presenting the bride to Himself, but presenting the bride to His Father. That's really something. Now, the analogy kind of breaks down in this. A lot of young men do not have proper biblical or godly fathers. But I know of situations where young men have found their bride. And to be so just almost overwhelmed beside themselves with joy, looking forward to the day, you know, Dad, I've met this girl at college, asked her to marry me, as you know, and I know you haven't met her, but I'm bringing her home this weekend, and I can't wait for you to meet her. And the rejoicing of the Father in the joy of the Son with His bride. Now, I want us to go just for a second. It's not really in the... Let's just go to Jeremiah for a second. Jeremiah 32. Verse 38, they shall be my people and I will be their God. Some people have said this is the desire of God's heart since the fall. As you go through the Bible, it's a reoccurring theme. They shall be my people and I will be their God. I will see to it that they will be my people and I will be their God. I will do a work to make this happen. He's not throwing out an invitation saying, you know, I hope somebody comes. But he's saying, I'm going to go out and I'm going to get for myself a people. And they will be my people. And I will be their God. And I will give them one heart and one way. You know how so many, it's not as big now as it used to be, but like in the 70s and the 80s, have all these Jesus parades. You know, unity parades. People, you know, with preachers on television weeping, the church is so divided and there's no unity, and oh, praying that God would do the impossible and make us one, which most people say never happens. Well, I want you to think about something. If the church is not one, then God didn't answer the prayer of Jesus Christ. Jesus prayed that the church would be one. And I want to submit to you today that the church is one. Always has been. The problem is what many people call the church isn't the church. Truly, the truly converted, regenerate Christian, that group, they're one. They really are. That's why you can sit down on an airplane beside a Baptist like yourself, person who claims to be a Baptist, have absolutely no fellowship with them. Because though they claim to be something, as you begin to talk to them, there's no life in them, there's no spirituality, they don't want to talk about God, they'd rather talk about Alabama football or something. There's just nothing. I mean, it's like you're sitting there with a dead man, because in fact you are. And yet, you could sit down on the same plane with somebody from the Nazarene church, who know I do not agree with all their theology. They are evangelical. They do preach a gospel, many of them. Many of them converted. Many of them I know more godly than myself. Sit down with a genuinely converted person from the Church of Nazarene and sit there and just talk all day as though you were brothers. In just a few seconds you discover, man, we're one. We're brothers. I'm not saying theology is not important, and I'm not saying the differences aren't important, but what I'm saying, you sit down beside a genuinely converted person and you'll die for that person within a few minutes. You will know them. You will know them. genuinely converted people. You will know them. Now, I know there's discussion, and maybe I'm talking a little bit too loose here, the idea of church and all this different thing, but you sit down beside a genuinely converted person, and you'll know it. And you'll be willing to die for them. I've shared this many times, but in the mountains, we were lost one time and in danger of our lives. And a little Nazarene woman, just upon hearing that we were evangelicals, that we were believers, brought us into her house and hid us down in the basement all night and prepared food for us and everything else. Hid us. Why? Christ. She didn't know us from Adam, except that we were believers. So it is one. Now, I will give them one heart and one way. You know what that way is? It's a way of conformity to Christ and a way of holiness. That's what that way is. And you'll see that in every true believer. They may disagree in some things. They may have some problems. But you will see one way in their life. One great goal and struggle, and that is to be conformed to the image of Christ, to follow Him, to be obedient to Him. Now, I will give them one heart and one way that they may fear Me always for their own good and for the good of their children after them. This does not teach us that children of believers are automatically converted or have a guarantee of being converted. But it does give us some great consolation and hope in this. If you're a child of a person who truly loves the Lord, what a benefit has been given you. And how good the Lord has been to you. Where you could have been born into a family of people who hated God, who never allowed a testimony of God to come to you. You are exceedingly fortunate. And if you don't recognize that, you are exceedingly stupid. Exceedingly so. Hard-headed and hard-hearted and just a spoilt, rotten brat. Am I making myself clear? Now, verse 40, I will make an everlasting covenant with them that I will not turn away from them. Oh, security of the believer there. I'll make an everlasting covenant with them that I will not turn away from them. But look at the other part. And I will put the fear of Me in their hearts so that they will not turn away from Me. Ah, that's where the Baptist, modern day Baptist, have it wrong. Now, everybody else does too, but I'm talking to my own family. Those who by and large in America today practice security of the believer or believe in the perseverance of the saints or that God who saves us by His power keeps us by His power. They have this idea. You see, all these carnal, wicked people who have nothing to do with God, church members all over this country who have turned away from Him, but they claim to have an everlasting covenant with God. But the evidence that God has made an everlasting covenant with you is that He has put the fear of Himself in your heart so that you will not turn away from Him. But if you can turn away from Him and live in the world, it's evidence He has not put His fear in you and not made a covenant with you. This is a spectacular verse. It's an absolutely amazing verse. Now look what it says in 41. I will rejoice over them to do them good. I will faithfully plant them in this land. Now look at this. With all my heart and with all my soul. Nowhere else is this said in Scripture. This idea of all my heart and all my soul. Now, this is speaking as a man. We cannot say God has a heart or soul. With the full force of everything I am, with the full force and power and faithfulness of all my deity, I will rejoice over them to do them good. Every bit of my divine resource will be employed to rejoice over them, to do them good, and to plant them in this land, to carry out the purposes I have for them. This is astounding. You talk about a consolation. You talk about he who began a good work will finish it. Takes that whole thing to a whole new level, my friend. Whole new level. I will rejoice over them to do them good, and will faithfully plant them in this land with all my heart and with all my soul. That's amazing. He rejoices. It doesn't mean that this is not a grudging God who grudgingly kind of metes out little rewards every once in a while. Or who almost his hand is forced to fulfill his covenant with a bunch of people he doesn't really like, but he made a promise to them, therefore he's going to go ahead and do it. That's not the way it is at all. He rejoices over you to do you good. And you say, well, I'm really struggling right now. I feel so alone. I feel beaten. I feel like the rod. Well, that can be part of the Christian life, but be very, very careful also. When God disciplines His children, He does not discipline them to bring them to despair without hope. Whenever Satan is, when you want to know the difference between the voice of God and the voice of the devil, God may rebuke you with very hard language, but He will always leave you with hope and give you the promise of return to me and I will return to you. Always. When Satan is speaking, it will always be condemnation. He will leave you without hope and he will convince you that the only thing left for you is to run as far away from God as you can get. But God, even when he has to rebuke you strongly, will always be calling you back, calling you back, calling you back. Now, let's go on to Luke 15. Verse 10, in the same way I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Now, in verse 8 and 9, of course, we have the parable of the lost coin. And what woman, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and search carefully until she finds it? When she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the coin which I had lost. In the same way I tell you, there is more joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Now, the phrase presence of the angels is a reference to heaven, the dwelling place of God. The primary idea is not that the angels rejoice, but that God's superabundant, joy because of the salvation of His people overflows to all of heaven and every heavenly creature or holy creature which dwells there. Literally, that when one sinner rejoices, God's joy is so great, it overflows through all of heaven and brings joy to every holy creature there. This is astounding. Now let me say this. You can so quickly discern when someone's apparent love is not love at all, but is more self-preservation or self-care. For example, a man has 10,000 sheep. If he loses 100 of them, it really will not affect his economics. And so a man loses 100 sheep, says, it's not worth the trouble. I've got thousands. He just goes on, and they're eaten by wolves. He is only thinking of himself. He has calculated and tallied up the worth against the trouble it would be to hunt them down, and he's decided they're just not worth it. He can go to sleep at night if he loses 100 sheep because he's got so many thousands more. Then there's the man who has 10,000 sheep and he loses one. And yet he can't sleep. He brings in all his shepherds to watch over the sheep in the corral, in the pen, and then he goes out for days to find that one sheep. When he comes back, his shepherds humbly question him, "Sir, it was one sheep. It was just one little lamb. Why waste the time?" Someone said of Bill Gates, now this may be an urban legend, but he makes so much money that if he saw, I don't know what it was, thousands of dollar check laying on the floor, if he dropped it, it wouldn't even be beneficial for him to bend down and pick it up, because the time it would take him to bend down and pick it up, he's already made much more money than that. "Sir, why did you go after the one? It was just a waste of time." There's only one explanation, because he really cared about the sheep. He didn't need it. He just really cared. Now, over one sinner who repents. The relationship between Hebrews 12:2 and this verse is clear. The joy that was set before Christ and that moved him to give his life as a ransom for many includes the joy of seeing a multitude of glorified saints redeemed by his own blood. Charles Spurgeon writes, "One sinner had repented, and all heaven must make holiday concerning it." Oh, brethren, there is enough joy in the heart of Christ over his saved ones to flood all heaven with delight. The streets of paradise run knee-deep with the heavenly waters of the Savior's joy. They flow out of the very soul of Christ, and angels and glorified spirits bathe in the mighty stream. We just all ought to stop preaching and just get up and read Spurgeon. I mean, think about that. Over one sinner, drug addict, prostitute, womanizer, murderer. And such were some of you. But you've been washed. It's just absolutely amazing. That is why these preachers today, I use the term very, very loosely, these preachers today who are more concerned about being your spiritual life coach and giving you practical principles to get your best life now in this world are doing a terrible disservice to the community of faith or to anyone who listens to them. The statement, "You're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good," is a devilish statement. A devilish statement. Why? Well, most people today are so earthly minded, they're no heavenly good. And secondly, the most heavenly minded people have been the most useful people on the face of this earth, and that's all there is to it. I'll give you an example, a guy I mentioned quite a bit, Frank Lombach. His entire goal, if you read his diary, he had one great goal. And that was to spend one day without one interrupted thought. He wanted to spend every energy of thinking upon just Christ, to meditate upon Christ one day without one interrupted thought. That was his goal. And Frank Lombach taught the entire Philippines how to read, so that they could read the Bible. He taught an entire nation to read, this man who was so heavenly minded, he was no earthly good. He was heavenly minded, and because of it, he was just Christ. To meditate upon Christ one day without one interrupted thought, that was his goal. And Frank Lombach taught the entire Philippines how to read, so that they could read the Bible. He taught an entire nation to read, this man who was so heavenly minded, he was no earthly good. He was heavenly minded, and because of it, he was earthly good. Christ was heavenly minded, therefore he was earthly good. We are called, Colossians 3, to do the same thing. Set our mind on things above, not on things on this earth. And you will be earthly good. Now, Matthew Henry writes, "There is always joy in heaven. God rejoiceth in all His works, but particularly in the works of His grace. He rejoiced to do good to penitent sinners with His whole heart and His whole soul." Again, it's not a miserly thing. It's not, oh, I made a covenant in eternity, therefore I have to keep this promise, even though I wish I hadn't made it. No. He rejoices to do good to them with His whole heart and His whole soul. He rejoiceth not only in the conversion of churches and nations, but even over one sinner that repents, though but one. I'll never forget, we were going to have this big meeting at the University of Texas. This was years ago, and I was a brand new Christian. And it was a great lesson and a great rebuke. We had been praying for a long time. We organized this thing, and we brought in a preacher who was quite, really was a man of God. And we thought the whole campus was going to be converted. That's what we were praying for, that the whole campus would be converted. And then after the meetings, we were all so depressed we couldn't stand it because only 5 people made professions of faith. And we were so discouraged that for a few days we didn't even follow up on them. It's like the whole thing was a failure. And then a dear friend of mine, Mike Martin, who's now a doctor in Tulsa, he came in and he was almost red hot with anger. He said, "Look at us. We're pitiful. We're just pitiful. 5 people claim to be converted in that, and we despise it. Because the whole campus didn't get converted, we're angry. Yet we won't even visit the 5. You know, and it was a rebuke to all of us. God rejoices over one person being converted. We should do the same. We should do the same. I want us to look at Edward Payson here, and this is where we finish this part of our study. And what I'm going to do is today I'm going to make sure that I have the notes, start printing the notes for the rest of all of this. Many of you just have this part. Some of you maybe have the second part. I'm not sure. How many of you, your notes terminate with what we're doing now? Okay, I thought so. Well, I've got hundreds of more pages so, that we can use. So I'll start putting that out today. Let's take a short break, and then we're going to come back and look at why God rejoices over the redeemed.